Hello, bus riders. Welcome back
on the bus. We didn't practice that.
Never. We're coming to you live from Quito, Ecuador at the Impacto co-working space. Of course, we found a co-working space any and everywhere we go. These guys are great. Huge shout out to them for plugging us in. They're looking at us as we do it. Thank you. Yes, big thumbs up.
You over there. Yes, sir.
From everybody over there. And
action. Well, upcoming, we have been releasing a ton of videos at our YouTube channel, which shows some of the incredible things we've been doing and people we've been talking to. We've already released our recent coffee adventure where we battled out in tasting different coffees in the coffee region. Tomorrow, or today when you're listening to this, you'll be able to check out the brandy tasting that we've done in Domecq Brandy. And we'll also be able to see the season one, episode number 6 of our Save the Dina tour. Now, we are going to be releasing new videos and episodes every single day of the week. So if you check out our YouTube channel, you'll be able to see new episodes of the Save the Dina tour on Sundays.
If you make sure you're subscribed, they're just going to show up. They're just going to pop up.
And notifications. They do it for a reason, for a great reason, because your brain links you to what we're doing. On Tuesdays, you're going to have, on Mondays, you'll have a new off the bus adventure. On Tuesdays, you'll have a vlog from the road, podcasts on Wednesdays, bus stops on Thursdays, and then more vlogs throughout the week and the weekend.
And big thanks and big shout out to everybody. You know, we wouldn't be this far if we didn't have this many people listening or these many people watching the video. So thank you to all of you. Please, if you can continue with sharing and passing all these things forward, a simple share, a like on all these social media pages, it means the world to us and it only helps us grow even bigger and grander.
Speaking of shout outs, we got down here due to a fantastic Kickstarter campaign and all the people who helped pledge to get us here. I know we're coming through. Thank you for following us. I have some shout outs to the people who helped us get here. Glory Edim, Kelly Hancock, Nicole Gabler, Jordan Rogers, Akash Deer, who will be flying down here, along with Lucy Miller and Lucy Millor and Manny to stay with us on the bus.
To play werewolf,
please no. Michael McGowan, Zach Hunter, and Andrea Cadavid. And yes, I will play werewolf with anyone that's part of the game.
Now, before we get into today's episode, a few quick commercials, a few short things. And before we get into today's episode, we had a few commercials, a few quick tidbits. So again, you don't want to hear these things, jump right ahead. I think I'm going to crunch to them in 2 minutes. So it's about the 5-minute mark, so you can hear about today's guest. First up and foremost, I got the downloaded spreadsheet right here. I have seen everything that people have been shopping on our Amazon portal, and I know what you're buying. I don't know who you are, but I know what you're buying. We got super protein bars. We got syringes. Someone's buying syringes and shooting up, but hey, glad we're providing a service for that. USB wall chargers, seat magnets. There was a real big one right here, $184 for a hot plate. You know, so again, all people, of you guys shopping through the portal.
They're really, someone really loves their plant, their nursery.
I'm going to give a shout out to Michael Hinden. I'm going to say that's a...
That has to be
him. Has to be them. Private Stock Veganics. Big shout, big thank you. And again, if you want to know how to do this, if you want to go do this, you know, it's all about getting more bang for your buck on your purchase. And this helps us fuel this bus, feed this bus, pay for these $30 fees to sit in this co-working space, to use this Wi-Fi. So you want to go head over to our website, onthebuspodcast.com. Click on that Amazon portal. It's going to highlight orange letters and shop till you drop. Favorite the page, and we really appreciate, like I said, if you want to tell me what you're buying, I can coordinate with you. I can give you an even bigger shout out and thank you on any and whatever social media that is. So again, that's our Amazon portal. And last but not least, we have Green Roads World and the delicious CBD oil and the CBD treats that we have. We have one of our videographers, photographers, Max over here. Max, what do you think about the Green Roads World? You've worked in a marijuana, as a marijuana store manager, no?
I absolutely have. And one thing I just want to shout out to them for is CBD in general is an incredibly impactful anti-inflammatory, 20 times more powerful than stuff you get over the counter in the stores. And Green Roads World is doing a phenomenal job of getting those products out to people. So if you haven't yet, check them out, buy it, try it out. It's a phenomenal product.
You don't just get to try it. You get a 15% discount when you use promo code ONTHEBUS O-N-T-H-E-B-U-S. That's lowercase, and it's all one word.
Helping bus riders sleep since 2017.
Since nobody else snores on the bus. And now we're on to today's guest. We have Richard McCall. Richard McCall is a journalist, hotel owner here in Bogota. He has made Bogota home and Colombia his home. And he also has a really prominent and out there podcast listened to throughout the world. He's been doing about 200 plus episodes. It's called Colombia Calling. And Richard's kind of, if you want to say, someone to look up to in the space. You know, on his podcast, he gets to go out and interview and share stories of people who don't really get that limelight, who don't really get the touch of information shared about of what they're doing and the really fascinating things that are happening, especially here in Colombia itself.
Richard's written for the Wall Street Journal, BBC Online, and the Daily Beast. Yeah, this episode is super fascinating politically, looking at the charged politics here in Colombia from the different sort of rebel groups, the history of it, everything back and forth about opinions in the outside world, tons of relevant information on Colombia today.
Especially about the news and information and how we absorb our information and how that's happening in Colombia and how you can compare that and relate that to the rest of the world. So it's an exciting episode. We're really happy to have Richard. Couldn't ask for a better show. So everybody, strap on your bus seats. Bus seat? Seat belts?
Bus driver, just cue the music.
Strap on, strap up. Journalist, podcaster, father, Richard McCall. Welcome on the bus. How are you doing today?
I'm okay, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show. It's a real pleasure.
The pleasure's all ours. We have such a great rapport. People we've met from, traveling through Colombia. We just got finished traveling through Colombia. We're in Ecuador now. It's one of our many Skype phone call interviews that we get to do. They're not always easy, not always tough. Had a few glitches, glamour before we get on the show, but happy to have you, happy to get you on. First things first, where did you get here? When did you get here?
Well, I arrived to live full time in 2007, but I started coming to Colombia in 1998. I've been living in all over Latin America between 98 and 2007 and just decided that's it, I'm moving to Colombia. I'm tired of moving around because jobs would move me from country to country, 3 months, year, et cetera, et cetera. I said, no, well, Colombia's a good place. You can see that things are changing. From 1998 to 2007, there's a big change in the country. And I never had any trouble getting work in Colombia as a freelancer. So that's very attractive for someone like me. And, it's an exciting place. It's never dull here, I have to say. And I did everything formally. I got my visa to stay as a journalist. The administration, the government administration, didn't really like journalists at that period of time, but for some reason or other, I got the visa. And yeah, the rest is history. I'm now a father, married to a Colombian, got a business, work as a freelancer, do a podcast, doing a doctorate as well at the moment. So busy. Colombia's been good to me.
You're really living the expat dream right now. But what about Colombia? What about Colombia? Why'd you settle on Colombia after all of Latin America?
Well, I tell you what, I like Brazil very much. I like Argentina very much. I've worked a long time in Ecuador, a lot in Peru, other places, spent time in the Guyanas, Paraguay, Bolivia. I thought about living in Brazil. I thought very seriously about living in Brazil, but the year before, in 2006, I very nearly died of some illnesses. And so that kind of put a bit of a dampener on my stay in Brazil. I had hemorrhagic dengue with malaria at the same time in a place without any good hospitals, and so they thought I was going to fall into a coma. I was in a public rural hospital. That was pretty unpleasant. That was a pretty scary time. My dad, who's actually Canadian but lived in London, he lost a kid in Brazil when he lived there in the 1960s, from his first marriage. So he's like, I'm not losing another child in Brazil. So I kind of decided, well, it's here in Colombia or Argentina. And I was in Argentina for a bit during my recovery stage, just eating lots of steak to put on some weight and some muscle again, because I was pretty skinny. And I'm 6 foot two. You can imagine I pulled to just above 50 kilos in weight.
Really?
After this yeah, I looked like, I was skin and bones, yellow eyes, yellow teeth. I mean, it was a thing of legends. Bad legends, but it was a thing of legends. And I was in Argentina with so many people claiming to be freelance journalists and just sort of doing very little. Just sort of living as I think you put it, economic refugees. It was just so much cheaper to live in Buenos Aires and do nothing than be in your home country. And I didn't like that. And I thought, well, I can go somewhere where I can make a difference. And Colombia is that place where I can really work solidly and hopefully, put forward my 2 cents. So that's why I'm here. And it's just been exciting since then.
Now, what were you freelancing on in Argentina? The same thing you're working on right now?
Well, my work was, obviously, I wrote freelance travel stuff all over the place. Occasionally some new stuff, where depending on where I was. But part of my job to supplement my income is I organized social projects for an English charity. So in Brazil, I lived in the favela, working with disabled orphans. And organizing people to come and help and come and spend their time just basically spend time with these children. I did environmental projects in the Amazonian, Ecuadorian Amazon, some stuff in Lima shanty towns. Argentina for me was largely pleasure. Bolivia as well, there was a wildlife sanctuary that I used to help with and so on and so forth. And then at the same time, I would lead expeditions. I was a trained high-altitude mountain guide and also a jungle guide. So I used to get freelance gigs everywhere, a month here, 3 months there, paying me in pounds when the pound was worth, times as much as it was back then. And so it was a good life, but, I was at high risk. I was always in the Amazon, and so I was high risk from all of these illnesses. I'm happy to say I've had none since, only typhoid since then. So I suppose I lack cholera yet, but I'm hoping I don't get it.
I mean, I think you're due, but we'll see what happens.
I've been pretty healthy for a while now.
Now, you came to Colombia, you thought you could make more of an impact. What kind of impact have you made with your journalism thus far?
Well, I don't know if I've made an impact, but at least I'm telling some of the stories that aren't being told. As a freelancer, it's what I want to write about and who I can sell the stories to. So I've written stuff for the Daily Beast about mass graves in Medellin when no one was writing about that, displacement of people, corruption in the elections for the Wall Street Journal. And remember, I'm a correspondent for a wire service in Europe, so I do a fair amount of television and radio as well. So, about things that are underreported. People, the media, they know I'm here. I've been here for 11 years now. They know whom, I know a bit about the conflict. I'm a conflict resolution specialist. I did a master's in that here in Bogota as well. So, you're not getting someone who's just dropped in to maybe report on something extreme and say, oh, no, this is amazing, this is incredible, this is terrible, look what's happened. If you hire me, you're getting, a weight of knowledge. I know what the conflict, I can, recite my dates back to 1964 and prior to that about what's happened in Colombia, what is the historic importance of certain facts, certain agreements. With the podcast, I hope to be, telling the story telling stories about the people doing things here and the situation that we live in Colombia as well. I mean, I get Colombians on who speak English and so on and so forth. But primarily, the big change that we have seen, let's say, social improvements is through a little hotel in Mompox that I created with my now wife. We bought the house in 2007 when nobody was betting on Colombia. No one was bullish about the country. Colonial house, it cost almost close to nothing. I was talking to my wife this morning. We were thinking how funny it is. In 2008, when we opened up the business, just with 4 rooms for backpackers, now we're a mid-range hotel. We run at 75% capacity with 11 rooms all year round. even the person who's my manager now really didn't believe that it was going to work. They were locals, so they didn't see the potential in their own town. And now we've seen change. You know, tourism is a trickle-down economy. People have had improvement to their lives. We were stopped by someone who just sells grilled meat in the streets not so long ago. He said to me, you know, I was able to send the first person in our family to do their first semester of university through the guests that stay at your hotel buying meat from my grill. You know, this is simple. That is social change, as low as you get, but it's social change. And so I hope, you know, I'm not on a soapbox saying what should be done, but just by hopefully leading by example, you know, hopefully my neighbors and hopefully other people, and now more people know about this town of Mombos. You know, guidebooks want to write about it, travelers want to come here, and upmarket travelers too want to come here. So the government has sat up and taken notice that there's been an increase in tourism. So then 3 years ago, they started a restoration project for the town. This wouldn't have happened if there were no tourists. You know, this wouldn't have happened. So hopefully we're doing something. Hopefully we're bringing about some sort of positive change.
What is a conflict resolution specialist? You can explain a little more detail about
it. Basically, I know all about the conflict.
Well, it's particular to Colombia's conflict with the war, with the civil war.
Study other places too, but Colombia was my primary interest.
Okay.
You know, I know why the reasons behind the conflict, the reasons why it hasn't been resolved in the years. And we do a course on alternative methods of resolving conflicts, which is tough, but it's interesting. But I've got a historical and political background to the Colombian conflict, with sort of taking into account from my background with the issue with Ireland and the UK, and then of course I used to live in Guatemala, and so I learned a lot about that issue, the issues in their long-running civil war. Well, of course, it supposedly came to an end in 1996, but I was living there in 1998, and it hadn't really come to an end there. So, you know, just to put it all into perspective.
Do you see a lot of correlation between the different conflicts that you've experienced and written about?
Yes. Guatemala and Colombia are very similar. The only issue really with Guatemala is it's not a producing country in terms of the cocaine trade, but it's a transit country. But the same flow of money goes through it, and the same levels of corruption and inequity in the country still pervade every level of society. There in Guatemala, as they do here in Colombia.
Well, let's backtrack even more, because I feel, you know, our listeners, you know, whether they know about Colombia, they don't know about Colombia, they don't really, they're tainted a little bit. You know, it's narcos,
sure.
It's drug wars. They really don't get the side of this, the paramilitaries, the rebel groups, the guerrillas, and, you know, how that's really extended farther back in the history of Colombia and this conflict in general. And even now, how maybe, you know, the narcos and the drug trade has, you know, blended in with these paramilitary groups over time. So maybe you can give a brief history.
Yeah, well, in a nutshell, but let me first say that narcos, you know, it's not made for someone like me who knows about the history, you know, inside and out. But I appreciate that series, that friends of mine who live in the US, Europe, Canada, etc., well, you know, we'll be talking on Skype, and they'll say, I had no idea about this, and we'll name something from the series, and you're like, it's great that now people are outside of the sort of sphere of being experts in Colombia know more about the situation. This is, you know, okay, it's been sort of glossed over and touched up in the Hollywood style, but at the same time, it's important that this dialogue, you know, takes place and people start to understand. But if you want to take Colombia after the period of the Spanish Empire, look at the whole of South America. The whole area, the whole region was incredibly violent. I mean, these were places where you could just kill your neighbor on a whim. So we're looking at the 1930s, we're looking at the 1920s. It's like you've taken a hornet's nest, you're shaking it up, and you're trying to let it settle. But at the same time, it can't settle. You're trying to claim land, people are trying to get rich. You've got this division between Catholic Catholic Protestants, which seems to be the same issue everywhere in the world, and liberals and conservatives. And the line was drawn that way. The line was drawn. If you were in a small town in rural Colombia, you were a liberal, you would cross the road and buy your drugs at the pharmacy if it was a conservative-run pharmacy. I mean, things were like that. Families were divided over political beliefs. And so you carried that in through what was the Thousand-Day War, and then that got carried across into the politics, the actual centralized politics of Colombia. And then you have these arguments between the elections, where one side was always claiming that the other side was stealing the elections and that they were rigged. So they created something that's called the National Front. We're talking prior to the 1940s here. They called the National Front, where it didn't matter how the election was held, let's say one party would get in, and 4 years later, elections would be held, but the other party would get in. So it didn't matter who won, actually, technically, in the vote. So every 4 years, it just flipped back and forth between conservative and then liberal. Until 1948, when Gaitán, who was the liberal, so let's say populist rabble-rouser, a candidate for the presidency, was shot in downtown Bogota on the 9th of April, and that created the Bogotazo. And that was really a spark for bringing the violence that was already had been running and pervading the countryside for more than 25, 30, 40 years, that brought it into the heart of the city, and central Bogota was razed to the ground. But that's the sort of official date, sort of, let's say 9th of April, 1948, that people say, oh, the conflict started. Actually, it has its roots far deeper than that. And so what you have are people then, sort of farmers, realizing that they're never going to get their land and they're never going to have these, you know, poor farmers, they're never going to have political participation because the elites, doesn't matter whether it's liberal or conservative, are going to remain in charge. And that's where you get the birth of the guerrillas, inspired, of course, by the Cuban Revolution, but taking on different elements of different revolutions elsewhere. 1964 is the founding date, like the FARC and the ELN. The FARC, of course, signed their peace agreement in 2016. The ELN is still very much active. Peace dialogues have now been suspended with them. But you've got the paramilitaries, who's surging up out of the late early 80s. They were first funded by themselves. Let's say they were actually sort of mercenaries being trained up by landowners and wealthy businessmen, and then of course they moved into drugs trade, the guerrillas moved into drugs trade, because of course there's so much money involved in the drugs trade. How are you going to fund your private armies? And it's a very, very brief sort of history. It's much more complex than this, but it takes us to the present day where we are now, where what we have are sort of, let's say, splinter groups all over the country, including the ELN, including with newly armed groups and criminal gangs and so on and so forth. It's a complicated situation, but what you see out of it is the Colombian government has been very bad in creating a sort of network of communication, like say roads, ports, and so on, and has no state presence in a lot of the country. I mean, you've driven through lots of it.
Yeah.
You all know that. There's no state presence. There's no education, there's no healthcare, there's no running water, and that's what people want. And if the only thing that's been offered to them has been a de facto state of criminal groups, what options do they have? I'm not saying it's a good thing at all, but I'm saying, what are the options left to the humble people in Colombia if they are not of a liberal or even conservative urban elite?
So what is the Colombian government? Oh, did it cut out? What is the Colombian government doing to enforce more of a state presence in some of those hard-to-reach areas? I mean, I always assume that such a vast territory is very difficult to govern.
And beyond that, there's a tiny percentage of people. Government doesn't do a great deal. As exemplified after the peace deal with the FARC guerrillas, they didn't move their military into these huge swathes of the country, which is the coca growing area. Why didn't they do it? We don't know. So it's,
it's a tough one, but Colombia's geography lends itself perfectly to an armed uprising, because you can run your own private army out there without anyone knowing. I have some friends who are in the military, and you say, well, why didn't you send your jets and your helicopters out there to, you know, inverted commas, pacify this region? And they say, yeah, you know, Colombia's really big. That's a captain of the army saying that to me. It's a tough country to police. And of course, you've got porous borders with Brazil, Peru, Ecuador, and now Venezuela. I mean, how do you police that? How do you stop people from moving arms, people, and drugs through these areas? It's very tough, and especially, as I've mentioned before, the money is so much, so vast. Everyone is corruptible. How are you going to do it?
And yeah, it's like, who, once you cut one person off and that affects, you know, not just one person, but a certain amount of people, how many people are going to come after you because of what you just did to them? And how many people does that even stem to, not even in the country of Colombia?
Yeah.
And then the pipeline is just endless. Now,
yes.
with the peace treaty with the FARC, I mean, I don't believe I have in grandiose detail of, you know, what was signed. I know it was done in Cuba in 2016. But, you know, what was written on paper? What was the things that they came to agreements on?
Well, it was over several points. Political participation being the first point. Second point was, first point was agricultural reform. Second point was political participation. Third point was illicit drugs. Fourth point was health with conflict. And fifth point, which is the one that took more than a year to debate, was the rights of the victims and justice. So these are the ones that, you know, in this sort of 230-page document or even longer were written down. Agrarian reform was agreed upon very quickly. It's going to be very difficult. People want a piece of land. Your rural countryside dweller wants a piece of land to be able to farm, to be able to produce, and be able to get his produce to market. That's what he wants. That's the basic thing. That's the basic underlying issue for the conflict in Colombia, is land ownership. And then comes political participation. Of course, political participation is important because you've got more political clout if you own land. So therefore, they're connected. Then now, what is land use and political participation? That then connects very nicely into illicit drugs. Of course, land use. What's the highest yield crop in the world? Well, it's the coke crop, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that then influences politics and so on. So this was all agreed upon. They were all agreed upon. And finally, how to, let's say, provide justice for the victims. I mean, there've been some good shows of remorse. There's a lot of FARC guerrillas have actually been to towns where they committed atrocities, you know, to apologize. I know it sounds trite, but to see the perpetrators of these violent acts come into a town and say they did wrong and to apologize is the first step in let's say, reconciliation. This is the first step. So this is something that's happening, but we're in a state at the moment where we don't really know how this special jurisdiction for peace is going to take place, and that's the justice system. Judges are being appointed at the moment for this. If you are a guerrilla and you have demobilized, so you're a FARC guerrilla and you've demobilized and you admit to your crimes, you're going to have several years in some sort of justice system. Around 4 years, probably working on infrastructure. You know, so things that used to blow up, like roads and bridges and ports and so forth, you're going to be building. This is not easy work, you know, this is not fun work, but you'll be doing that. If you don't admit to your crimes, and you're found to have been guilty of various things, then you're getting 8 years plus in jail. You know, again, that's no laughing matter either. Anyone who's guilty of any crimes against humanity will not be let off on any level at all. So these are the systems. Now, the guerrilla have a good point. They're saying that the paramilitaries who demobilized around 2006, if I'm not mistaken, 2004, I can't remember exactly, there was a sham demobilization. It was kind of like for show. Some gave in their weapons, demobilized, but those criminal structures stayed in place. So the guerrillas are saying, well, we we need security and we need to be ensured our own protection. Because what happened in the 90s when part of the FARC disarmed and became a political group called the Patriotic Union, there was a summary assassination against many of their rank and file, which took thousands of people. So a genocide against this political party. Even their presidential candidate was assassinated. So there are big fears this happens again. That you know, now we mobilize, we don't have our weapons, we've handed those into the UN. But what's to stop these paramilitary groups from just, you know, knocking us off, picking us off one by one? And why are they in liberty now? Why are they out when they've committed these crimes against humanity? So, you know, and rightly so, there should be an equal form of justice for both parts. And that's where we find ourselves in this present situation in Colombia. Pretty tough, though. I mean, pretty tough, pretty complex as we're coming in. We're in an electoral year. Presidential elections are being held in May 2018. We'll probably go into a runoff 1 month later, so June. And we don't know who's going to win. We don't know if they're going to be pro-peace. We don't know if they're going to, you know, try and bin the peace accord. Technically, they can't because it's been written into law. But at the same time, they'll find loopholes in which they can change things. I mean, nothing's ever written completely in stone, is it? So we'll see how it goes. I mean, this is a very complex year for Colombia.
Yeah, that's been like the thing. Everybody we've talked to, whether they've been
everyone
in any kind of field, whether it's an artist or someone doing social work, everyone is on edge about what's going to happen in May. They say, I don't know what's going to happen. And it's just a topic that just gets brought up in conversation. Like, where do you think it's going to go? And everybody has their own...
Yeah, I couldn't tell you. Normally, you'd be able to predict who's going to win or who are going to be the two front runners. Right now, we couldn't say. And of course, now, given 2016 and the no vote in the referendum and 2016's Brexit vote and 2016, the Republican Party winning in the U.S., none of us believe any opinion polls anymore. You know, it's like, so you've got to take everything with a pinch of salt. I mean, everyone thought, you know, whatever you really, you thought, we thought that Clinton would win, we thought the yes vote for the referendum on the peace accords would slide in very easily, and of course I thought the UK would vote to stay in Brexit. Now you have to truly investigate each thing. It's not about who you surround yourself with, you've got to talk to other people too.
Does that have anything to do with approval ratings? Like I read that Juan Manuel Santos, the president of Colombia, you know, he's got an approval rating of 20-23%, and I mean, I don't see that as being too high, but does that have anything like runoff and to say like, oh, well, this guy's got this low of approval rating, you know, it goes in to say, I don't know what's going to happen, or is there anybody that's following him up in the present election, someone from the same party?
Well, no one really wants to be tarred by that brush by being a statista, let's say. Yeah, he's got like 20% approval rating, which is the most peculiar thing for me. You know, he's succeeded in disarming around 8,000 people. That's 8,000 fewer people running around blowing up stuff. You know, some of those will go into criminal gangs and so on and so forth. But if you take an example, there's a Colombian think tank called the CERAC. The CERAC has said, in the same period of time that we have been with a demobilized guerrilla, the FARC, we can estimate that 3,000 people, 3,000 plus people have not been killed. You know, they did a study, and the conflict had run on for a year and a half. Now, think about that. That's 3,000 families, you know, twisted by hatred towards the National Party of Unity or whatever, the Santos Party, because they don't want to be seen as a Santos legacy. Anyone who's taking up the mantle of Santos will not win the election this time round.
Yeah, it seems like that tradition's holding true. You're talking about from the 20s and 30s with, okay, 4 years, one party in, next 4 years doesn't matter, we're going to have a different party in. It seems like that's just reoccurring. I mean, it almost happens in the U.S., you know, that with our elections. It doesn't matter who's in. The parties really, you know, they're on the groundwork are pretty much the same. They believe in the same things, the same laws and bills are going to be passed. you know, just with a different twist. We're gonna lower taxes here, raise taxes there, but nothing really changes. And it's
no.
I mean, I would say this is different. You know, you said taking 3,000 people off out of the streets, the jungles, and having them turn in their weapons is something completely different. But I'm talking in terms of the level of politics.
Yeah, honestly, the people who still control the big business here, they're still in control. You know, that's it. The first people to visit the president, whoever wins on his, you know, on his inauguration, always the families that run the sugar, you know, the huge sugar plantations, then those who are in control of, you know, petrodollars, and then there's those who's in control of another big industry. These guys are the ones who pull in the votes, who are able to manipulate the countryside and so on and so forth. So, you know, they might be able to lower taxes on one thing, but then they'll raise it under a different name in a different place. You know, things don't change particularly. And that's why, for example, you know, I have staff, my cleaning staff, for example, in my little hotel, La Casa Maria in Montpós, they tell me outright that they sell their votes. You know, they sell their votes. They get offered like 50,000 pesos on the way in to vote and 50,000 pesos on the way out. That's 100,000 pesos. For people who earn the minimum wage, which might be around 760,000 pesos at the moment, that's a significant portion of an income. So 100,000 pesos, and they're probably a single mother, probably got three kids to raise. This is just one small town I'm talking about, and they'll tell me openly, what's going to change for me? I've got a dirt floor, no electricity and no running water. Do I really believe that voting for one of these guys in a nice suit who went to a nice school, who went to university overseas, is going to make any effort to change anything for me in this tiny, rural, impoverished town? I mean, that's the reality of it.
But these aren't systems that are even, you know, from Latin America or South America. You know, this is, you know, say democracy, this is socialism, this is communism, whatever party, you know, whatever political orientation someone's going to bring in. You know, how are these things, how these things are failing the people?
Yeah, you think they're all family, but, well, I don't know. Some families believe themselves to be better than other families. It's very difficult here. There's a feudal system left over from the Spanish colonial period that's still in place here. You know, if you're white and European and of the first conquistadors, you are obviously of the Colombian royal class, and you'll definitely have family members who are involved in politics. If you're indigenous or black descent, you're in the lower class. I mean, that's it, and you will be kept down in this situation. And Colombia had an incredibly restrictive immigration policy right up until recently. I'm going to say in the 1950s, 60s, if you couldn't read or write, you weren't allowed in. I mean, you didn't get a European underclass coming in. You only had a European upper class coming over to exploit Colombia, which meant you keep the locals down. The aboriginals, the original settlers of this land, are the people who are kept down by the European top. And so it's very tough. It's a very tough situation to deal with. I don't know what the solution is at all. I mean, I think what we've got is a new generation coming through, you know, who will hopefully be voting this time around and hopefully be believing in the power of the vote, who have not grown up during the most, let's say, violent years of the Colombian conflict. You know, they were maybe really, really little during the 80s, born in the 90s. So they don't remember Colombia when it was a capital of cocaine and kidnapping. They don't remember any of this, or family members having been kidnapped. Of course, they've all got stories about family members, but prior to their generation. And so these kids who maybe have been, you know, to high school in the States or in Europe or college, university, elsewhere, maybe they're coming back to do something different, to try and cast their vote for a different Colombia. I genuinely believe, I've met a lot of people who are Colombians who are now coming back from their experiences abroad with a far more altruistic outlook towards the country. So hopefully they cast their votes and actually genuinely believe in a political situation and the political potential for change.
Yeah, you see it's possible to have cultural shift as you start incorporating outside cultures, as the kids go off to universities like you were describing. And I think that one of the probably difficult parts of that are still the untouched regions where you're not going to get a cultural shift, where you're not going to get that change, where they're still adhering to property rights and sort of the ways of the old sort of communities and farms. And if there's a way to, I would imagine, like from my perspective, there has to be a sort of way to trickle in that cultural shift into those communities.
But that's the problem, though. All those small little communities, maybe in the rural areas, adopt those older ways.
Yeah.
One person takes power, now they're going to grab the land rights and they're going to be in control of the land and making sure it's going to stay with that feudal system and they're going to stay in control. And it's hard to break that system. It's hard to break that cycle. Where does journalism play a role in, just as you mentioned, the conflict and educating people, you know, in and around Colombia and the world?
Well, journalism, I would love it to play more of a role, but self-censorship here is very high. If you're a journalist at a local radio station, you know, Colombian journalists at a local radio station, local paper, you are under threat.
Have you received pushback? Have you personally received pushback from any of your investigations?
I received a nice phone call from a general in the military once. That put me a little bit on edge. I wrote something for the BBC many years ago, and what I wrote was not how it was interpreted, because the main news magazine in Colombia, it's called Semana magazine, saw the article in English and translated it into Spanish. And they translated it, it wasn't a like-for-like translation. And it made it look like I had written the military were equal to the guerrillas and the paramilitaries in terms of massacres and atrocities. And of course, I hadn't written that. While I may believe something of that nature, I hadn't written that. I'm not stupid, and I had to get Semana to take the article down and apologize to the military. And then Semana then asked me, "Well, do you want us to write an apology?" I said, "No, I don't want anything else. I don't want to be in the news. I don't want to be the news." This is not what I wrote, just take it down. And, you know, as soon as it's down, people will forget about it. But to have a general, you know, obviously, you know, generals have access to phone numbers. I mean, I didn't know who this general was. And he called me up at like 8 o'clock in the morning and basically screamed at me down the phone. And it didn't directly threaten me, but was quite vociferous in his arguments. That was a little bit chilling, let's say.
I imagine that's better than a knock at the door.
Yeah, well, I was in Santa Marta on the coast at a meeting, and my wife was home alone. I just remember calling her up and just saying, "Don't answer the phone, don't answer the door, back in Bogota." And she's like, "What have you done?"
I know that one right there. What have you done this time? Listen, just don't look out, watch out, don't answer the doors, keep the curtains closed. You don't want to know.
Just don't ask. Go out for a bit. I'll call you back when this blows over. It took about a day.
What is your overall take on the media, journalism, and publicity all around the world with the rise of populism and nationalism and opinions?
Well, it's tough, isn't it? I mean, there's no such thing as objective journalism, in my opinion. By the very newspaper we pick up to read, by the very TV station we choose to turn on, it shows what kind of news or what kind of information we choose to receive. By the very Twitter feeds that we sign up to follow, you know, you can tell, that's it. The language that I employ in an article will show where I stand on the fence, what side of the fence I stand on. So It's a tough time for journalists at the moment, especially when you have your guy to the north shouting fake news. Now, fake news has always existed. It's propaganda. You know, that's the word that it's been. It's propaganda. But we think of propaganda in more political terms, of course. You know, like big Soviet era posters and like the newspaper Pravda and stuff, and of course propaganda from the other side too. But to scream fake news at people is to really you know, undermine what they're doing, and so they kind of influence their viewer and their core base, even aggressively. And I think that's just not doing journalists justice. And at the same time, I mean, I'm a journalist, so of course I'm going to come out and defend my background. But at the same time, there are those journalists who have the right to be questioned on what they're doing and where their politics lie. But you know, if you watch Sean Hannity, for example, you know why you're watching Sean Hannity. If you're watching, let's say a talk show with Bernie Sanders, you know who's watching that. So I don't know why it needs to be so aggressive. I don't know why it needs to be so violent. This hatred, and everyone, you know, people stand up and go, it's the media's fault. Well, you know, you can always find media that's more in tune with what you believe. You don't have to follow these things. You know, if you don't like the New York Times, don't read it. You know, don't read it. In Colombia, self-censorship is very, very highly followed by journalists here. And of course, you've got to be careful too. The El Tiempo, the main newspaper, was owned by the Santos family for a long period of time. You know, Santos, the current president, he's still got interest in it. You know, they say things about him, but they don't, let's say, fly off the cuff and criticize him outrightly. Yeah, you know, these things are, but they're very careful in the way that things are done. And the editorial line here is very gentle to the people, the main political families. So you have to know this, and I think there's also, you watch the local TV, the news here in the morning, and it's just filled up with car crashes, accidents every night. You know, they're not telling us the real news. They're giving us sort of what's more of a spectacle. They'd say, whoa, it's so bad, someone drunk driving killed a mother and their kids. Yes, it's dreadful, but that's not national news, but it passes for national news, you know? We should be hearing really what's going on in Venezuela, what's going on with that border, because that's affecting all of us, you know? And the Venezuelans coming across, there's more than a million, and yet the government still sort of says, oh, it's around 350,000. You're like, that's just not true. No, we know it's not true. So it's a tough one. There are people, obviously, who know how to interpret and who know how to understand the media, and then there are those who take it at face value. Either one is correct, but you need to know what you're watching or reading.
It seems like what the news has become is a form of entertainment that people have been able to cue on the on tribalism and say, okay, we're going to throw some showmanship. We're going to enhance on your little monkey minds. That's going to really enhance. For example, like, don't listen to these guys. They're going after your well-being. That they're going to make you pay even more money in taxes. Well, is that actually happening? Where's your information? Where is this actually coming from? Where's your substantiation? But questions stop after, you know, two or three back conversations and dialogue, and then nothing else is there. It's let's get mad, hands in the air, and that's it. But where's the solution? Where can we all come together? Why can't we?
Well, I don't believe I have the solution. I don't know where it's going to go, because of course, you know, the onset of reality television, and of course viewer ratings, and phone-ins and whatever, you know, it's all permeated into news. And so it is, like you say, it's entertainment. It's not cold hard news. And I guess you've got to change it for the audience. I mean, I know I was younger, and I sound like an old guy when I say this, but younger generations doesn't watch TV anymore. You know, just watches YouTube, watches Netflix, streams on Apple TV. So things need to be streamlined for that generation. People aren't reading as much long-form journalism as they used to. Long-form magazines are going out of fashion. However, there is a demand for that. You know, it might not get as much advertising as before, but people will still read the New Yorker, the Atlantic, and so on and so forth. But it has its place, but we need to learn how to streamline. Obviously, podcasts is one of those things. You know, people are downloading hundreds upon thousands of podcasts, you know, something that they thought 10 years ago was going to disappear. But the ease of getting the information out this way to younger generations needs to be exploited. Here in Colombia, podcasts really haven't taken off yet. The main news outlets cannibalize their radio shows, and of course that you understand that because people still have the radios and TVs on 24 hours a day. It's not like elsewhere where you're commuting all the time or you're in your car or something else. But it will change. It will take time, but it will change, and the media here will need to streamline the way that they deliver their information. I think, I don't know what the solution is at the end, how you decide what is the editorial content, how you decide what people need to hear. I mean, it's very, very difficult situation, but at the same time, you need to realize that the traditional journalism methods have changed.
Is that what you try to do in some of your freelance work? You know, try and fill the void that the news doesn't cover?
I'm just trying to inform a little bit more about Colombia. You know, a famous American war journalist, war photographer, Jim Hoagland, who died in El Salvador, he once said, you know, do something bad, I'm going to take a photograph of it. Do something good, I'm going to take a photograph of it. Make sure you do something good. So I report on bad stuff, I report on good stuff. I prefer to report on good stuff, but if it means we have to talk about bad stuff, then we're going to talk about bad stuff. I just want to inform on about Colombia.
That's a fascinating thing. You see that Colombia is missing a certain form of news. They're not hearing this, they're not hearing that, but you're able to provide some of those things, tell those stories aren't being told, in terms of like, hey, you know, there's these a million people actually coming across the border. There's, you know, another bombing that just happened in Barranquilla. There's, you know, that bridge collapsing, 10 people. However, that's what people outside Colombia see, though. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they only see that negative bias. And I can't help but see that, you know, that has a more of a negative impact, not just on Colombia or, you know, whatever country gets a bad rap or the country gets the news on, but it has a worse reputation in the countries in the Western world or outside who not just don't want to come visit, but the negative biases get formed on them.
Because as justifiably been hammered by the press and for good reason, but and obviously bad news sells. You know, why is it that DWTV in Germany calls me up for stuff when a boat sinks? I don't want to report on that, but. You know, I have to pay the bills too.
It's the opinions of people before we even came down on this trip where they still had this sort of old world opinionated view of Colombia. Be careful of this, you know, don't take these roads.
You're going to get kidnapped.
You're going to get killed. And we've come down here and it's been almost the complete opposite. And I think one of the hardest things is sort of changing the perspective, the viewpoint from those people. But it is that the media that's being provided to them is still... You know, it's still paramilitary. It's still the bombing in Barranquilla. It's still those types of perspective, and it's hard to engage people with a new viewpoint.
It's an incredibly hard sell. Colombia is a hard sell. You know, I've worked in tourism for a while here now, and I'd go to the big tourism fair, which takes place in February each year, and travel agents would be brought down by the Colombian government to potentially buy tours and so on, and would just sit down and say, I can't sell Colombia. I can't sell Colombia. But now it's changing. You know, that we had more than 5 million tourists last year, I think it will be much higher than that now. That's a country still with a conflict. Of course, they're not going to the real danger areas.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to a thick column of the country which doesn't have issues.
They don't mention that, though.
But it will help. With 5 million people go back with positive views of Colombia, they'll talk to their families. It's a process. It's going to take generations. You know, I'm English. People still here go, oh, you're a hooligan. You know, I've never seen a hooligan in my life. But that's it. It takes generations.
You know what it takes? It takes them driving on a bus with us over the trampoline of death. That'll change everybody's perspective.
So you're driving this big yellow bus down through the Americas. You guys used to export those buses to transport down here. You know, you used to say, like on the side, Mercer County Council, or Mercer County Education System. Are you going to leave it and donate the bus when you finished?
That's on our minds. You know, donating it. We've had a bunch of people, you know, offer to buy it from us already. Hey, when you're done, here's my card. I'll take it. Like, people wanting to buy just the frame.
They've never seen anything like it. It's very intriguing for them.
Yeah, hitting the rural towns up and just the number one thing that people do is they stick their head underneath.
Underneath, yeah.
Like, there's something else that they've never seen before underneath the bus. Yeah. We got videos of 20, 30 people. Was it about that many, Patrick? And just, is there something else underneath here that just doesn't exist that I've never seen before? It blows their minds. And it's, I think my take on it is just like, you know, anybody else coming out from, you know, any other country is going to think, these people are going to rob me. These people are doing something. They're conforming against me. You know, these people are just curious. You're a stranger coming in to their town. Same ideas and same things that you would do if anybody came into your town with a huge thing they've never seen before. They're just curious. They want to ask questions. They're there to find out about it. Yeah. And, I mean, that's why we travel.
Cool. Very cool.
Okay, yeah, we're gonna close up right now. The few follow ups, if you finish your questions. Who were some of your mentors or heroes in the space?
Tough one. One of the journalists who I used to really, really follow very, very closely was called Martin Bell, an English journalist who covered the war in Sarajevo, and then he became a politician. He ran independently and became a politician. But he was one that was really very key for me in my sort of, let's say, student years doing my master's in journalism. In terms of radio, I listened to more comedy than anything else. The BBC Radio 4 comedy shows and stuff have always been huge, had a huge influence on how I want to tell stories. But reading, I mean, I devour books. I try and read a few books a week. And I don't know, when I figured, if I was talking about travel, it would have to be Paul Theroux and Peter Matheson. If it's about news and so on and so forth, and news and travel, A.A. Gill, who tragically died last year. I had the pleasure of meeting him and chaperoning him around Bogota when he came down for a travel piece. He was a big influence as well. Having spoken to him in person, Adrian Gill, and he would look over some of my work and tell me, you know, this needs this and this needs that. That's, you know, it's great feedback, you know, for someone who's really, really famous to give you time to talk about these things. But in terms of literature, I would, you know, give my front teeth to be able to write like someone like John Updike or Ian McEwan or someone of that nature. I would devour anything.
if you had the inside scoop on one story from the past, from any era, in any part of time, you know, what would it be, and what perspective would you write it from?
My word, any era.
Yeah,
history
guy, go for it.
Yeah.
Quite like the Cuba Missile Crisis of 63 would be quite fun. And to tell it from a different perspective as opposed to, you know, an East Coast perspective. To have been on the ground, maybe observing, maybe from a Cuban perspective, you know, just like a regular guy there expecting the missiles to arrive, you know, something like that would be really interesting. Because of course that was, you know, of huge importance at that period of time.
Oh yeah, or even like Raul Castro's yeah, perspective, not even Fidel's.
That'd be fantastic.
What were you thinking?
Yeah, why?
And if you weren't a journalist, what would you be?
A bum. I don't know. I think my parents wanted me to be a lawyer. That was never happening. Thank God for that. I don't know. I really don't know. Sometimes I think about it and I don't know. I think at school we had to have all of these kind of conversations. What do you want to be when you grow up? And people could never identify anything for me. You know, the guy to my left was going to be like a professional fisherman, someone else was going to be like an estate agent in real estate, someone else was going to be in banking. And they always went, Richard, for you, we don't know what you're going to do, but you'll be rich. Unfortunately, that's not the case, but I'm happy.
Imagine we reach a world without conflict. What do you believe would ultimately bring people together to reach that sort of utopia? If anything. Is it possible?
I don't know if it's entirely possible, because you're always end up being envious of your neighbor somehow. I just don't think there's a possibility there. What I would like to see is a greater dialogue. I don't consume any drugs at all. I mean, but I would like a greater dialogue around the legalization of narcotics and drugs. I just think that would produce a lot of issues. Mm-hmm. I don't think there can be a utopia, but I think we need to discuss certain things that can perhaps bring levels of violence down.
I was going to go one deeper and just say psilocybin mushrooms and LSD and just dump it in the water source, but I go one little deeper. Richard, thank you so much. Really appreciate you taking the time, the call, a little technical difficulties. Really appreciate it. And before we sign off, please let people know where they can find you, where they can read your stuff, your website, YouTube, and your podcast, please.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. Of course, it's been a real pleasure to be able to talk so freely with you guys about pretty much everything. I didn't expect to be asked about a utopia. Please tune in to my podcast. It's available on all your streaming devices, streaming apps. It's just Columbia Calling. Yeah, we do a weekly podcast talking all things Colombia, but it revolves around social issues, politics, culture, travel, whatever, you name it. My blog is just richardmccoll.com, and you can find all my published works there as well. And help me out, because I want to find a publisher for my book. So, you know, we're all out here struggling together. The pie is big enough for everyone. Please, you know, tune in. I'd be happy to hear from you.
And yeah, before we go, just want to say thank you once more. You know, if you want to say a hero mentor, at least for me, you know, we can say, you know, somebody wants to cover these stories, you know, of people telling stories that don't get the coverage they deserve. So, you know, it's great to see someone who's doing the same work as us and has been doing it much longer. So thank you again. Thanks for taking on the bus with us.
Thank you.
Cheers. Richard, thank you so much for taking a ride here on the bus with us. This was a pleasure to have you on the show. I know we both enjoyed it. And if everybody is interested in knowing and following Richard's stories, Richard's writing, you're going to go to richardmccoll.com. That's his own personal blog. We're going to find some of his freelance work. And you're going to find a place to listen to his podcast. And you're going to find that wherever you listen to podcasts, it looks like we're on the same levels. SoundCloud, Player FM, iTunes, Stitcher. And that's Columbia Calling. And then he's got a tag for all of his social medias for the podcast. That's a Columbia Calling on Facebook. I don't believe in Instagram, but there's going to be a Twitter for that. And then on Instagram to connect with Richard, you have RSN McCall, McColl. And again, Green Roads World, Amazon, go click on those links. Make sure you're subscribed to our podcast. You're going to find that iTunes, Stitcher, same places you find his. You want to hit YouTube, please go check out the YouTube page. We're working really hard on these videos. We're really proud of them. We got a really solid team here of Patrick and Max. We couldn't be this far without them. You got anything else left?
Nope, just a big thank you.
Big thank you to you. Now get off our bus.
This is the moment for those who...